following programme entitled Crime and Criminology was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. This programme firstly explores the definition of crime. We then look at some possible triggers or predictors of crime, such as low literacy, early school leaving and mental health issues. This ties in with the background of a typical perpetrator. We go on to discuss blue-collar versus white-collar crime, and we ask, is there more crime now than before? Does prison work? What do victims say about prison and the perpetrators? Can criminals be rehabilitated? And what is restorative justice? Firstly, I met John O'Keefe, who teaches a course in criminology. John is a journalist, criminologist and law lecturer. John's contribution will explain criminology and, more importantly, set out many of the strands pertaining to crime and its perpetrators.
Certainly. Well, my name is John O'Keefe and I'm director of the Institute of Criminology at City Colleges. I mean, really, the whole debate is one of nature or nurture. So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about, is it something in the DNA or is it something we learn? However, we do go through the evidence, and it's very much evidence-based in my view, and we do need to consider what we have before us as opposed to emotive opinion, which of course we're all bound to have from time to time, including myself. So we will look at things like the biological correlates of crime. As I say, is it in the DNA, or perhaps it's more social and environmental, perhaps geographical. We also spend a number of lectures looking at a thing called psychopathy, which is a much abused term, but really is central to criminal behaviour. Are all criminals psychopaths? And what indeed is psychopathy? How does it manifest itself? Well, we know, of course, from previous history that psychopaths are not just in prison, of course. They're running boards and they're CEOs of companies, but they went to different schools. So what we try and do in that particular, and what's interesting about it, I suppose, is we're linking nature and nurture and seeing what comes out in the wash. And sometimes it's the infamous psychopath, the person who has absolutely zero empathy. So we're trying to get behind the criminal brain. What makes somebody a criminal, or weren't they indeed born a criminal?
Worth noting from John O'Keefe's contribution is the nature versus nurture debate. Paraphrasing crudely, we can say, are criminals born with some sort of developmental weaknesses, which in turn predispose them to committing a crime, or are criminals born like you and me, that is, non-criminal people, people who do not commit criminal acts? Are they born like us, but subsequently, due to disadvantage, are turned towards criminality, are turned towards antisocial behaviour? Now, I talk to Owen Carroll, who will also tackle the triggers or tackle the approaches that are being made to understand the roots of crime, the triggers of crime. Owen Carroll, Advocacy and Social Policy Research Officer at the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice.
You can understand it very much from either a psychological or a sociological perspective. Psychological perspective would suggest that somebody lacks discipline and that they need to be punished and they need to be told that what they're doing is wrong. That's a psychological perspective. Also, psychological would suggest that actually this person is making a free decision. They actually have completely free will and they've made a calculated decision that involves themselves, and they see an opportunity and they snatch and grab. Sociological perspective is a much broader perspective and would be a lens or an approach that I would come from, which is realizing that society gets what it creates, and if it's a young person who has been marginalized from their own community, they haven't had the life chances that others, the majority perhaps, have had. They then see it as something to get involved with. But also, I mean, if you look specifically then at individuals, you find that they're trying to either feed a drug habit, and I think for a lot of people who are involved in low level crime, it's very much trying to feed a drug habit.
Owen Carroll of the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice prefers to take a sociological perspective on the triggers of crime, on the triggers of criminal behaviour. John is a middle-aged man who first went to jail when he was 20 years of age. John, when did you leave school?
When I was 14.
When did you do your first crime? Would you call it a crime?
First time I was in trouble with the police, when I was about 13, for being drunk and disorderly. And then when I started getting into serious crime, it was about 19 or 20. That's when I start getting into this when I was first went to jail when I was 20. But I had to do it. And what can you do? You just got to do it. If you do crime, you have to do the time. If you get caught.
To John O'Keefe, who explores some of the reasons or triggers for criminal behaviour.
Education, literacy, dysfunctional families,
all those things, I don't want to be flippant and say they're all in the mix, but they are. There are a couple of things we look at, though, that are really, really important. I'm going to sound old-fashioned when I say this, but I do have some academic evidence for this, so I'm feeling more comfortable in saying it. So much is down to parental role modelling. If there isn't a parental role model, things tend to go out of control. As we all know, as kids, we all need boundaries. Why do we need them? We need them so we can push against them. If we don't have those boundaries, guess what happens? We fall out. Now, unfortunately, in these criminal families, it's generation upon generation. So not only are there no boundaries, but indeed they're encouraged to cross those boundaries. And that's where the difficulty arises. Interestingly, though, there are plenty of single parent families out there in socioeconomic areas which might be described as deprived, whose children never commit crime. So what's going on there? A lot of evidence is showing it is parental control and or supervision and or, of course, love. I should say and love. And again, when we talk about criminology and you use a word like love, people say, you know, what are you talking about, John? But guess what? It's kind of still what makes the world go around. And if people have loving parameters and boundaries, I'm just giving you this now in a more pub talky way, then, of course, they will respond to that. When that's gone, they don't respond. Interestingly enough, there is a perception out there that having the father at home is critical to a child's upbringing. A lot of evidence says not necessarily, but in fact the central person is the mother. If the mother is a single mother and can adopt insofar as someone can, both male and female roles, both father and mother, the outcomes for the child in terms of lack of criminality are likely to be very good. On the rare occasion there's just a father in the house and there's no mother and he's strong, it doesn't work as well. People tend to slip into criminal arenas. So the mother is so central. So let's just go back a bit. When we look at people, those people you're talking about in Mountjoy and their backgrounds and what they're like, we have to say, you know, where was the mother in their lives? And a lot of them will report feelings of being abandoned. Now, that can be literally abandoned. The mother can walk away. It can be not showing them love. It can be divorce. It can be death. It can be all those things. But as far as they were concerned, they weren't loved. And again, just not to sound a little bit emotive here, but we all know there's no greater thing in life than to love and be loved.
There was a ragged band that followed in our footsteps, running before time took our dreams away. Small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay.
To develop the definition of crime, we go back to Owen Carroll. What is a criminal act? What is crime?
A criminal act is something that involves breaking a law. So it's socially constructed. Not to get too technical, but somebody has decided, or a group of people have decided, that this act is now considered a criminal act and can be punishable in various different ways, be it a fine, a community order, or a prison sentence. Certain acts are considered criminal and others aren't. So, for example, we now see a situation where certain acts in relation to planning, there's a push to now make those acts criminal. Now, I don't know any specifics, but the most important thing is we can't look retrospectively. So while there's public outcry about wanting certain speculators, builders, developers to go to prison, essentially they can't go to prison unless they've been found guilty of a criminal act. And if there is nothing in law that they've broken, well then you can't do anything. Certainly then when you look at low-level public offences, if you look at the number of people that go through the courts each year, there's over 100,000 convictions in the court, which is a lot. And of that, about 12,000 to 13,000 persons get sent to prison. So we see that most punishments don't involve prison. They would involve a fine or the poor box or community service or a suspended sentence.
Dr. Christina Quinlan has written a book called Inside, Ireland's Women's Prisons, Past and Present. Dr. Christina Quinlan completed her PhD in 2006 at Dublin City University. She is currently a lecturer at DCU. Who defines what crime is?
I mean, I feel that we all know the answer, really. The people who have power define what a crime is, and the people who have power confer criminality on particular kinds of behaviour in society. And we've seen that, how easy it is to criminalise and then prosecute the kinds of crime that poor people engage in. How easy it is to prosecute somebody for stealing something, for breaking and entering, for engaging in an assault. It can be very easy to prosecute those kinds of crime. White collar crime is it's almost impossible to criminalise. It's almost impossible to prosecute. It's so complex. Often the people who are attempting to bring forward a prosecution don't really understand the crime, and they can't really unravel the crime. It's just so complex. And those are all reasons why I think we have predominantly poor people in prison. The grass was greener.
What are you thinking of? What's somebody thinking of at the moment they're doing a crime or getting in trouble? What do you be thinking about?
Money. Cash. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. Cash. Making money. That's why people commit crime. And then, but other people commit other crimes for other certain way things. You know, it's all different types of crime.
We've heard from the perpetrators of crime, and we've heard, to a large extent, explanations as to why the perpetrators might commit a crime. However, there is another side to the story, and that is the story of the victims. Robert was recently mugged, and he told me his story. How do you feel towards the culprits?
Well, it's hard to say. They're obviously kind of desperate, just walking around and get the wallet picked out of the pocket, and they're obviously in a situation where they need, they want the money, but and they're just going to victimise somebody because they can't see a way to get what they need besides taking it.
But does that amount to a full and complete exoneration of the culprits?
It would be nice to be able to, try and track them down, or just to, try and get something done with the stolen good. And I kind of went about trying to get something done about it, but unfortunately I had no luck.
How should somebody who steals €300 from you, how should they be dealt with by society?
Well, I think they should certainly, an example should be made that, it's not all right just to mug somebody. They should be made an example of in some way, and then made think about what they've done and hopefully become slightly better.
Would the example you're talking about, could that include imprisonment?
It could do, or it could be community service of some kind, or just something to try and help get them back on track. To a glimpse of how great it was on the other side. Steps taken forwards, but sleepwalking back again. Dragged by the force of some inner tide.
I provoke Professor John O'Keefe slightly. They made a choice. If you make a choice, you make your bed and you lie in it, and don't start crying and whinging.
I think that's right if you're right. In other words, if they are simply waking up one morning and saying, you know what, I think it's time I just got myself a Tesco's bag and started running around the bridges of Dublin and bouncing off cars. I don't think they make that choice. I think the choice is made for them in many occasions. And what do I mean by that? I mean that a lot of them suffer from mental health issues. And I think that really is key. We can't pretend that anybody in their right mind would choose that life. There would be some people who would. Nobody chooses to be homeless, in my view. Nobody thinks it's a great idea to live in a shop window. Nobody thinks that's fantastic. If they do think it's okay, and if they do think it's an alternative, then I think we have to look to mental health issues.
According to some of our speakers, for many of us, most of us will not engage in any criminal activity because of the lack of incentive. In fact, the incentives for being caught committing crime can be harsh, and for a law-abiding citizen, maybe the consequences are judged to be too harsh or not worth the effort. Economist Stephen Levitt and New York Times journalist Stephen J. Dubner wrote a book called Freakonomics, which explores the hidden side of everything, including crime and crime figures. Here now is a passage from this book.
We all learn to respond to incentives, negative and positive, from the outset of life. An incentive is simply a means of urging people to do more of a good thing and less of a bad thing. Some of the most compelling incentives yet invented have been put in place to deter crime. Considering this fact, it might be worthwhile to take a familiar question: why is there so much crime in modern society? And stand it on its head: why isn't there a lot more crime? After all, every one of us regularly passes up opportunities to maim, steal, and defraud. The chance of going to jail, thereby losing your job, your house, and your freedom, all of which are essentially economic penalties, is certainly a strong incentive. But when it comes to crime, people also respond to moral incentives. They don't want to do something they consider wrong. And social incentives. They don't want to be seen by others as doing something wrong. For certain types of misbehavior, social incentives are terribly powerful. Many American cities now fight prostitution with a shaming offensive, posting pictures of convicted Johns and prostitutes on websites or on local access television. Which is a more horrifying deterrent, a $500 fine for soliciting a prostitute, or the thought of your friends and family ogling you on www.hookersandjohns.com?
And that was an extract from Freakonomics. Dr. Christina Quinlan on why we lock up people in the first place.
Nobody cares really about prisoners, and nobody cares about prison. Prison is there not for prisoners, but for the rest of society. That prison acts as a deterrent because most of us would rather do anything at all than go to prison. So we're prepared to go to any lengths to ensure that we don't go to prison, and so we abide by the rules. And that's how prison works, and that's how prison functions in society. And in a way, I suppose that's true. We would all be so terrified at the thought of a prison sentence that we'll do anything, we'll obey any rules, we'll pay any taxes and abide by any laws, so long as we can maintain our own personal freedom. So is that how the prison works? Is it, if you like, a state ideological apparatus? Is that how the prison works in society?
Former prisoner Paul explains why he was jailed and challenges the definition of a crime. He then goes on to tell us a little bit about his life and times. Paul, do you accept the word crime?
No, not really, no. I don't accept the word crime. It's criminal what's happening to human beings, the way they're led. So the first time I ever stepped in the court, I was laughed at, mind that step, and got big time. And I never did anything. I only came out of the army. Never done a thing. First time I stepped in court, I got a long time. And I was just helping somebody, that's all. And it wasn't particularly a crime, it was a defence. Everything that you do is not a crime, where if you defend somebody's life and it comes out that the other person that you're trying to save, well, the other person you do damage to, just in protection of that person, where's the crime in that? It seems that I'm an ordinary Dublin bloke. Get down them stairs.
I asked ex-prisoner Paul to tell me a little bit about himself.
Well, I left school straight to work. I worked as a first with the milkman and then the coal. I had to get out and get money. There was nine of us in the house, and you had to get out and get money. It was a recession. much worse recession than these days. You know what I mean? So it's basically it.
How many bedrooms and rooms were in your house?
When we were kids, it was only one room. Do you know what I mean? Because it was tenements. You know what I mean? So, like, well, we got out, we got a house, and things, my sister got killed, and the family broke up, and loads of things happened, so.
Do you understand, or do you think that young men, it's harder for young men to resist crime, or it's harder for certain young men to resist?
Well, it's a bit of peer pressure, isn't it, when you're hanging around with a load of gangs, a gang of kids. Well, there's nothing for them to do. Do you know what I mean? They'll kick bikes, take bikes, do something simple. But they're getting terrible time for little petty things. And when big crime, like if you go out and embezzle millions of pounds, you can turn around and walk away with it. But turn around and walk in with a bank with a shotgun and walk away with 20 quid, you're going for a long time down the jail. The person that knocked down my sister, that was a crime. But they had the proper solicitors and they never went to jail. Do you know what I mean? So, if you're from Dublin 1, get down them stairs. If you're from Fox Rock or any Dublin 4 or wherever, go to school, get your education, then go to jail. Everyone forgets about them people. One law for the rich and one for the poor, as his famous song says. Do you know what I mean? Seems that's the way it was. The more money you have, the less time you'll get, the best solicitors you get. You know, so look, your man that killed the board and he got away with it, the black fellow, I forget his name, O.J. Simpson, you know, he was loaded, he got the best of solicitors, and this is what's happening in Ireland as well. It's all over society. You just feel like you hit the short end of the stick. Now, I didn't carry on crime at all. Like, I went and went to further education. Got myself worked ever since I got out. Lost my job just over this recession. So I'm not going to go back to crime to do that now. Just use my head.
Decades of studies have shown that a child born into an adverse family environment is far more likely than other children to become a criminal.
However, let's not lose sight of the victims. Back to Robert, who was recently mugged. Do you, inverted commas, understand why these people might have been driven to steal from you?
At the time, I had a bit of money in my wallet, and there's a good chance that when I was shopping in one of the shops, or they might have even seen it sticking out of my pocket. They could have seen me, you know, either putting the money back into my wallet. And I usually wouldn't carry much money around with me. I just happened to be lodging it that day. So they could have seen that and then decided that they'd, you know, try and take it. Because I wouldn't say they'd try and do it to somebody that they didn't see with any money on them.
Generalising somewhat, we might be able to assume that these people were relatively disadvantaged, or were in fact disadvantaged. Would their disadvantage or their possible disadvantage colour your judgment on their actions? So much so that you might even feel compassion for these people. In view of the fact now, I'm reminding you that you were the victim of theft.
Somewhat, I feel sorry for the person who's robbing somebody because, you know, they've put themselves in a situation where they could possibly end up in jail or with court sentence, or they're putting themselves in a situation that they don't need to be in, and there are other ways to get what they need, to get money, and even to maybe they're dealing with some addictions as well that they might need to, you know, need help with. But robbing off somebody isn't going to help them in any way. So
We briefly take a look at white-collar crime versus blue-collar crime. If one is more harshly treated than another, why might this be so? Owen Carroll.
I think it's because it's the seen crime. It's what you see in the streets. So compared to something like tax evasion and other fraudulent acts, it doesn't physically impact on the individual. They don't see it in their daily life. Also, it's much easier to explain some of the language coming out in relation to NAMA and the banking system and quantitative easing. We don't understand. We're told we don't understand it, and it's certainly not explained in a way that we'll understand. But we do understand red top newspaper headlines that says 17-year-old joyrider smashes third car. So I think it's as simple as that. It's very much what's seen in front of us.
Up to now, we've been largely dealing with low-level crime. I now speak to a man who was left for dead after a severe beating.
Well, to be honest, I never thought in my life that I'd ever be attacked by anybody in any fashion or form, because I was always fit and able to take care of myself. But under the circumstances that happened to me, when I got assaulted in New York in the subway, it was probably one of the worst things that ever happened to me. Because it was a violation of me as a human being, and physically I was left for dead. But obviously I didn't die. But I came out of that very traumatized, very 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 broken, and it has taken me actually quite a few years to come to terms. It did take me quite a few years to come to terms with that. And I lost an inordinate amount of confidence in myself as a human being. I became very distrustful of people in general and all of that. One of the things that it did do to me was it made me a very angry person, because I see it in all aspects of life in different countries that I've been, certain kind of people that prey on others and violate them. And it's akin to like what I would feel, how a woman might feel if she had been violated by a man. Or and I can only identify with them, on empathize with them on that particular situation, even though mine was like a beating, like a severe beating, but it still had the same effect on me. So, you know, to a certain extent, I harbor no real anger or resentment, but deep down inside, when I really try to think about it, when I reflect back on that situation, it does bring up sweats and things like that in me, because I was left for dead. I really was left for dead.
Right now, what punishment do these people deserve in hindsight?
Well, as the Bible says, an eye for an eye. You know, but I'm a pacifist at heart, so I really don't believe in dishing out punishment, the same kind of punishment. I feel that social and economic situations do attribute to many aspects of people and their behavior. I feel that, like, you know, in that particular part of New York, which is Harlem, it's a drug-infested situation, and unemployed, and, you know, if you're a white person in that particular area, well, you stand out like a sore thumb, and, you know, you're ripe for the taking. So really, the onus was on myself not to actually be there, but I was there by accident and suffered the consequences. So I don't believe in, you know, punishment. I believe in education, and I believe that society does have a responsibility to, you know, like, try to educate people in life, and you know, like, sometimes, you know, it takes a tragedy for people to actually really come to terms or understand that their actions can actually be very, very disturbing and very dangerous. It's maybe, you know, they've got many, many reasons for being how they are, or whatever, you know, mental illness, you name it, drug activity, all kinds of stuff, broken homes, different things, so on, social, you know, like, economic disabilities as opposed to others who have everything, and so on and so forth. But it does not excuse them for being running around and just beating the crap out of people to take from them, because really, it's just not nice.
The grass was greener.
In January 2014, Liam Herrick was appointed as advisor to President Michael D. Higgins. However, from 2007 until 2014, he was executive director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust. His work at the Irish Penal Reform Trust involved engaging with international human rights treaty bodies on their monitoring and examination of Ireland's compliance with its international obligations to advance reform of Irish law and policy. We began our brief conversation by focusing on the fact that would-be criminals and criminals make a choice when they commit a criminal act.
If we look at what crime is about in society, it's a combination of things. It's a combination of individual choice, but it's also a product of circumstances. It is not a coincidence that most of the young people that go into places like St. Patrick's Institution can't read and write. It's not a coincidence that most of them come from the poorest parts of our large cities. And it's not a coincidence that they come from families that have had serious problems with family breakdown, addiction, domestic violence and so on. So, of course, everybody's responsible for their actions up to a point, but we can't ignore the social reality. And the social reality is that, to a large extent, our prisons are full of people that have come from the most marginalised sections of society. Many were in the care system and many were failed by the state in terms of being excluded from school at an early age, being grown up in areas of chronic unemployment, and also by being mistreated or neglected within the care system. So you can't acknowledge that we have all those problems in society in one hand and then be surprised that some of these issues play themselves out in our criminal justice system.
Professor Ian O'Donnell drills down into the detail behind the crime statistics and also touches on the concept of white-collar crime again.
I'm Ian O'Donnell, Professor of Criminology in University College Dublin. The typical prisoner is a young man from a working-class part of a deprived urban area. In a nutshell, they're the characteristics that they share. They're overlaid with low educational attainment, drug misuse and so on. But I think it's important to say that they're not necessarily the most serious criminals. When we think of crime, we tend to equate it with the crimes perpetrated by those young marginalised men. But if we look at the situation in Ireland today, where the country's been brought to its knees by the criminal activities of a few, they don't share those characteristics. So when we think about crime and punishment, I think we need to be very crime specific and to say that the prisons are full of people who commit certain kinds of crimes. They tend to be property crimes of low value, but they're carried out by people on a persistent basis, which cause them to become entangled with the criminal justice system and end up in prison. There are other kinds of criminal conduct that cause huge damage to society. They rend the fabric of society. They're carried out by people who share different kinds of characteristics. They tend to be well-educated. They go to particular kinds of schools. People wouldn't associate them with the criminal class per se. And we need to think about those individuals and their conduct as well when we're trying to think about the harms that crime causes to society.
Despite all the attention paid to rogue companies like Enron, academics know very little about the practicalities of white-collar crime. The reason? There are no good data. A key fact of white-collar crime is that we hear about only the very slim fraction of people who are caught cheating. Most embezzlers lead quiet and theoretically happy lives. Employees who steal company property are rarely detected. With street crime, meanwhile, that is not the case. A mugging or a burglary or a murder is usually tallied whether or not the criminal is caught. A street crime has a victim who typically reports the crime to the police, who generate data, which in turn generate thousands of academic papers by criminologists, sociologists, and economists. But white-collar crime presents no obvious victim. From whom exactly did the masters of Enron steal? And how can you measure something if you don't know to whom it happened, or with what frequency, or in what magnitude?
Professor Ian O'Donnell contrasts the punishment meted out to low-level blue-collar criminals as opposed to white-collar criminals.
There was a study done in the Dublin District Court in the mid-1990s by Ivana Bacik and Mick O'Connell and colleagues in Trinity College Dublin, and they found that, taking everything into account, people from the most deprived areas were 50% more likely to go to prison than people from less deprived areas. So for the same kinds of offences, the likelihood of imprisonment was higher for the people from the deprived areas. The people from the deprived areas were also less likely to be fined. That's to do with their means. But if they were fined and they couldn't pay, they ended up in prison in default. So all of these kinds of factors tend to work together in that way.
You are listening to Crime and Criminology, a programme which has been funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the TV licence fee. Now, in an attempt to further drill down into how crime can affect a victim, we speak to two organisations which were set up in order to support victims of crime. It has been said that many perpetrators of crime are in fact victims or are in some way victims of social exclusion. Maeve Ryan, the coordinator of Crime Victims Helpline, explains that there is another type of exclusion, that experienced by the victims of crime.
The way the criminal justice system works, and you probably know this, is that the victim of crime in the justice system is regarded and has only the position of a witness to the crime. They've very few rights. They have very little influence on how a case is dealt with. They have very little control over how things happen, when they happen, how quickly they happen. In fact, they have no control over that. In effect, the case is handed over to the state. The victim is a witness. The case is the state against the perpetrator. That's what leads to the sense of exclusion, because a victim has, you know, as I said, no input into decision making in the case, and oftentimes no real knowledge of what exactly is happening behind the scenes. So they make their report to the Gardaí, they make their statement, and then they wait. And that waiting period can be as long as 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, whatever. And during that period, of course, they can get some information from the Gardaí, and the Gardaí have committed to keeping victims of crime informed of how case is progressing. The reality is that the Gardaí are most likely to inform the victim of crime when there is a development in the case, and that may not be for 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 months. You know, if you are a victim of a crime such as a burglary, which in the scale of things is a minor crime, but for the person who is affected by it can be a major incident in their life and have serious consequences for family members. Once they have reported that, there may not be any progress made in finding who the perpetrator was, and there may be no case. So, you know, all that sequence of events within the criminal justice system just leaves people feeling disempowered and excluded. I would use the word excluded because that's the word that we hear from people who call our helpline.
We heard Maeve Ryan of Crime Victims Helpline explain the concept of exclusion. ADVIC is an organisation which advocates for victims of homicide. Some years ago, Annie Mulvaney lost her son as a result of a violent attack. A man was convicted of manslaughter of her son and was sent to jail for a lengthy sentence. Apart from everything else, Annie Mulvaney wants to underline the fact that the only time she was able to contribute to the court case was when she made her victim impact statement. She feels that this is not enough.
A family has a right to give a victim impact statement, and it is extremely important because...
Why is that? Yeah.
Well, I think for me, and I can only speak for myself because I've gone through it, it is the only time that you will be recognized within the courts as part of the process. Like, again, if I can go back to my own case, the court case lasted weeks and weeks. Only once were we allowed, requested to speak, and to speak about what had happened to our family. There were weeks and weeks where nothing that happened to us was important, or nothing was even mentioned about our child. So that is why it is so important, because the criminal case or the criminal court does not really give any importance to the victim of crime. And especially if the crime is homicide, the victim cannot speak. So the only time that you feel that you are part of it is through the victim impact statement.
I asked Annie for her opinion on the concept of understanding the perpetrator, understanding the mind of the perpetrator who was responsible for the death of her son.
It's more or less impossible to answer your question. Personally, I just would not I would not want to go there. It is too personal and I would not want to go there.
When I speak to Annie about the difference between manslaughter and murder, Annie recognises that there is, legally speaking, a difference between both terms, both crimes and the ensuing sentences. However, for Annie, having lost a son, a death is a death.
Once a person has been killed, if it is murder or homicide, murder of manslaughter, it doesn't really matter because the person has been killed. But the law actually makes it different. And what the law is saying is that when a person has been charged with manslaughter, it means that it says that there were some circumstances that were not... That made it that it less, if you want,
intentional.
Yeah, less maybe. Intentional.
So we say manslaughter is homicide without the intent.
But actually, what is happening so often is that the charge will be murder, but actually during the court case, the person is charged with manslaughter because it is so difficult for a jury. During the court case, the defense is going to go on so much about why actually there was no intent, why something happened with the person that was killed that made it, you know, that it's not actually murder, it's manslaughter, that it is very, very difficult for a jury to actually give a verdict of murder, and that's why so often it is manslaughter.
Has your particular incident in some ways made you a stronger person?
It has made me a changed person. I think I would not have been able to live my life after what happened to us without trying to do something about changing the way our family had been treated during the criminal investigation.
Still on the topic of victims and the consequences of crime, especially serious crime, we go back to Maeve Ryan of Crime Victims Helpline, and we discuss the phenomenon whereby some crimes will go unreported.
There are various reasons, but I suppose the most common ones are fear of the consequences, particularly for people who have been victims of assault by somebody that they know and who face the risk of further attacks if they report the crime, or who have been threatened or intimidated about reporting the crime. And I think another and very understandable one is people who are victims of sexual violence. It's such a difficult, such a sensitive, such a painful crime to talk about and to report. Particularly victims of sexual abuse by somebody they know, and there are huge consequences in their life and the lives of the people around them for reporting that crime. So they do need to think carefully about what's going to happen next if they report. And we also encourage people to think about what happens if they don't because basically if they don't report the crime, nothing is going to happen.
How does a victim's advocate feel about the idea of trying to understand criminals and criminal behaviour?
We understand the huge difficulties experienced by many people who become perpetrators of crime and end up within the prison system. And in fact, a lot of our callers understand those difficulties as well. And, you know, there isn't any one view that victims of crime take on this issue. Some people feel understandably extremely angry when they're a victim of crime. They feel angry with the perpetrator, they feel angry with the system, they feel angry with the guards, they feel angry with us. It's a very normal effect of crime to experience a lot of anger. And some of that will be directed naturally at the perpetrators of the crime. We also have callers who, you know, feel an understanding of why crime happens, the way society is structured, the reasons why an individual who has mugged them, even broken into their house, taken their possessions, whatever, the reason why they have done what they've done or the path that they've been on that has led to this. And, you know, we do have callers who can express great understanding and even sympathy and total lack of desire for retribution. So, I mean, there's a wide range of feelings and views there about that.
Life was tough, but I just committed crime because I just did, because I was easily led, and I think when I look back on it now, it was just stupid, you know. I'm sorry, if I could put the clock back, I would never have got myself into trouble. But as I say, now as I'm getting older, I don't get into trouble, and that's the main thing, you know, because life is so short, and and prison is hard, and I don't want to be there all my life, in and out, and in and out, and in and out, that cycle. It's just not on, you know.
We now turn to consider the following proposition. Is crime on the increase? Let's take a look at the facts and figures.
You know, people need to realise in the last 100 years, globally, crime has just rocketed downwards, not upwards. Crime is... we've never had such a little crime in Ireland. There are some exceptions. Burglaries, violent crime and murder have over a number of the last 10 years fluctuated upwards a little bit. But if you look at the graph generally, it's downwards. The people who are most concerned about crime are the people who need to worry about it least. For example, old women and gentlemen living down the countryside in farmyards with their shotguns cocked needn't worry. You know, the law, on average, they're not going to be attacked, burgled or anything in their lives. The people who really need to be worried are the 21-year-old males going out in the town in Dublin on a Saturday night and having a word with somebody as they pass them in the street. These are the people who need to be worried about crime. Of course, they're the people who are least worried about crime because they think they're invincible.
Dr. Christina Quinlan.
And I think that the media has played a very important role in all of that. And I think that the media is responsible for a lot of the negative understanding of prisons in society and the negative understanding of prisoners. I know that in Scandinavian countries where there is no tabloid press, there isn't the same resentment of prisons and prisoners as there is in Ireland and in the UK and in other countries where there is a tabloid press. And it's not appropriate to deal with people who have offended against the criminal code the way the press sometimes deals with them. It's not appropriate and it's not fair.
I asked Tom Brady, security editor of the Irish Independent, if crime rates had gone up in Ireland.
No, funny enough, crime is on a downward slide at the moment. Crime has been down continually in 12 out of 14 categories over the last year or so. The last quarterly reports, maybe the last 4 to 6 of them, have indicated that crime has been down in 12 of those categories. One area which was showing a huge increase up to about a little over 2 years ago was burglaries, and that was driving up the overall crime rate. But the Garda Commissioner set up a special operation codenamed Fiacla, and that has offshoots in every region in Ireland, and that's now turned out to be very successful, and the increase has been curbed and is now showing a downward trend.
Despite the facts and the figures, would there be a part of society who would feel, or who would always feel, that crime is on the increase?
Yeah, I think despite the figures, there's no doubt there's a perception in certain areas that crime is on the increase. For example, those people I was talking about who are being affected by travelling burglars, a lot of their victims that are being targeted are in rural areas, elderly people who are living alone. They see they're being denuded of resources. You see the closure of Garda stations, even though in effect they're probably getting a better policing service than they would have, but the fact that the local guard is no longer there, the same with the post office being shut down, generally they feel society doesn't care about them anymore. So the perception is there that they are more likely to be attacked than they were in the past.
Can the media directly influence criminal justice policy?
There's no doubt about that. Yeah, the government is made up of politicians, and politicians always do what they think will help them curry favour with the public, and the media play a large role in that. Very often the media overreact to particular incidents, and then there's a clamour on for legislation. The politicians always feel they have to do something, and sometimes even bringing in legislation that it was well intentioned, but it doesn't work out. We had, for example, when there was a steep rise in drug crime, they brought in legislation which meant that anybody caught with drugs worth over £10,000 in all money, or €12,700, should be sentenced to 10 years. What had happened was the judges don't like being told what to do, so most of them, initially, they just refused to implement it. Eventually, there were what were called seminars, where judges were meant to be trained by senior judges on how this legislation should operate. And in more recent times, we have seen the judges operating this legislation to an extent, but it is still very limited, and it probably wasn't a very well thought out piece of legislation.
And that was Tom Brady, security editor with the Irish Independent, finishing off that section of the programme. Now we turn to prison itself with a simple question: does prison work? The authors of Freakonomics have little doubt about the answer to this question.
Harsh prison terms have been shown to act as both a deterrent for the would-be criminal on the street and a prophylactic for the would-be criminal who's already locked up.
Maeve Ryan of Crime Victims Helpline on harsher prison sentences.
I think that's very simplistic. You know, it's a huge task to understand why crime happens, and it's a huge task to understand what will work to address the problems that give rise to crime. In my personal opinion, that is not locking people away. Prison is, I suppose, ideally a place where the person who has committed an offence will experience some kind of rehabilitation. Does that happen? Does it work? I think we all know the answer is no. Prison isn't working, and people who go to prison will often learn a lot more about crime and the commission of crime and successfully committing crime in prison than they knew before they went into prison. There's a lot of drugs in prison and a huge amount of violence in prison, and it's a totally dehumanising experience for anybody who's unfortunate enough to be consigned to prison. So no, we don't believe prison works.
Professor Ian O'Donnell on whether prison works or not.
It certainly works in terms of incapacitating people. So while people are serving a sentence, they're not offending against their community. They may be offending in prison, but they're not offending against society. So it has that very limited effect. Does it deter people from reoffending? Clearly, in many cases, it doesn't. Does it deter other people in society from getting involved in crime? It might have some effect at that level. Does it rehabilitate people in the sense that it gives them the tools to rebuild their lives or to make sure that they are less likely to offend when they come out? The evidence is mixed there, but I think we should aspire to having prison systems where people are treated well, given the opportunities to address the causes of their offending, whether they're to do with anger management or drug misuse or what have you, so that when they come out, they're better equipped to lead a law-abiding life than they were when they went in.
British broadcaster John Snow.
Prison's a fantastic dumping place, but it's amazingly expensive, and of course it pollutes the young person. They've come into contact with extremely dangerous individuals. But I've never really seen any young person go to jail and come out of it a better individual.
John O'Keefe on whether prison works.
I think this is something we need to come to terms with in Ireland and indeed abroad as well, is that not everybody is redeemable. It's a hard thing to say about some people. Those people who are suffering from psychopathy cannot be redeemed for a whole host of, we'll call them, DNA reasons. So what do you do with those people? All you can do is keep them off the streets, keep them away from harm and try and manage them. Of course, you offer everybody rehabilitation, but also recognising that there is a significant minority who can't be rehabilitated for a host of reasons. Psychopathy is one of them, but they've just got so much stuff engendered in them, they can't unlearn that behaviour. So it's sometimes not possible. That doesn't mean we don't try, but on the other side, it doesn't mean that we assume everybody's going to be cured, if we want to call it that. Because if we believe that, we'll cure nobody. We just have to recognise that some can't be, and we have to manage them in a different way.
Former prisoner Paul gives his opinion on the alternatives to a prison sentence.
Well, I'd say try to get them a bit of work. Put them into an education. You know, even if they have to be displaced, but make sure it's not just sitting in a cell, changing a pot and waiting for the time to go past. Give them inspiration to not cause crime anymore. Make them feel proud of themselves.
Restorative justice is a system of criminal justice which focuses on the rehabilitation of offenders through reconciliation with victims and the community at large. We briefly go back to John, a former prisoner. Did you ever meet a victim of a crime, or did you ever meet a victim of one of your crimes?
No, I never did, no. I never did.
If you did, would there be anything you could say?
Now, as I'm older, looking back, of course, I'd say I'm sorry. When I look back now, I'm sorry I ever got myself into trouble in the first place. I suppose it's just youth led astray. It can happen to anybody.
Maeve Ryan.
There are many benefits in the restorative justice process that would never be found within the criminal justice system as it exists. We really believe that for a victim of crime, an acknowledgement of the crime is really important. An understanding of how the crime came to happen is very important. Some expression of apology from the person who committed the crime would really be significant for many victims of crime. And some effort at compensation, whether it is financial compensation or by other means, would be hugely significant to many people who are victims of crime. Restorative justice gives a voice to a victim of crime, gives them an opportunity to talk about what's happened and how it has affected them and their family.
What victims want is not necessarily more punishment and more punitiveness to satisfy them. It's some reparation, some restoration of the situation to get them back to where they were before the offence. So I think there are two things going on there. One, that these aren't two distinct groups. And secondly, that each of those groups doesn't have, you know, particular attributes and perceptions and understandings of the problem. That it's a lot more fluid and a lot messier than that. And that a lot of people who are victimised by crime want to ensure that they're not victimised again. And they want to understand why they were singled out. Because a lot of crime victims are anxious about their victimisation and feel that they were chosen because they had certain characteristics. And if they're given an opportunity, for example, through some process of mediation, to meet with their victimiser and to learn the circumstances around the crime, that can provide the kind of reassurance that somebody being punished or fined or jailed can never provide.
This programme, entitled Crime and Criminology, was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. A special thank you to all of you who contributed. This is 103.2 Dublin City FM.